Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with Michael Rietblat, who is the CEO and founder of Forter, and Sean Sarkissian, who is the founder and CEO of Cortex MCP. Michael and Sean, thanks for joining me today for a great discussion on encryption and protecting consumers and their data.
Thanks, Karen. Always great talking to you and Sean as well.
Yes, absolutely. Good to be here, Karen.
So let's put context, not that we really need to, given the events of the last couple of days, but just to kind of put the conversation in frame. So we now have two different but very related incidences that have really stoked the debate over encryption on a worldwide basis and here in the U.S. The first, the DOJ's decision to postpone the hearing about Apple and the issue about their refusal to allow access to the phone that was in possession of the San Bernardino terrorist. That's one issue that has really flamed a discussion about where the lines of security and privacy begin and end. And then, of course, the unfortunate situation in Brussels, which hasn't yet surfaced any evidence that encrypted communications played a role in those unfortunate terrorist incidents, but it has created the conversations worldwide about the need to think about the privacy and security debate around the tactic itself. So switching this now to payments, because obviously encryption covers a lot of ground. We talk about encryption and payments as being very critical to securing card data and customer data from compromise. So I think we recognize that we need to do that. Tokens are an enabler to that. The layers that Google and Apple are adding to their operating systems are creating an opportunity for that as well. So my question for you both is, are we having the right debate right now about the right set of tools with respect to encrypting customer and card data, securing data, but also creating this environment where it's also private, and who has access to that if they need it? Michael, what are your thoughts on this now?
So I think the driver for encryption, especially in the payments or general authentication, is user experience or user preference question, and not necessarily kind of a government or Apple decision to defy the government. Right? We want to pay with our phone. Or someone thinks we want to pay with our phones. And to do that, we have to store our payment options in the phone somehow. If it will be very easy for a typical criminal to steal my payment information from that phone once he gets access to it, whether remotely or physically, I will not store my credit cards in that phone and I will not use it. So from Apple's perspective, if they want to offer me a payment option using my phone, they have to make sure and they have to convince me that my financial data in that phone and my identity data in that phone is protected. And encryption is one of the best ways to protect data. It's not a bulletproof solution, but it's a very important one, especially if you want to make everything else very, very easy. You don't want to have two-factor authentication in the middle of my mobile transaction. On the other side, it does create a significant challenge for the intelligence community or the law enforcement community, because now criminals can use different types of encryption. Now, communication encryption is different than authentication encryption or financial method encryption. So they're kind of two different products, two different challenges. But I think it's up to the intelligence community or the law enforcement community to find different ways to overcome it and to track terrorists or criminals. And there are ones, right? In the past, we couldn't even tap phones that easily. And it's a constant cat and mouse game between criminals and terrorists and law enforcement. And I think it's up to the government to find a solution around it or to fight the motivation to do any crime and so on. But let's not get into that.
No, I was going to say, I mean, at least in terms of payments, right, specifically, I think payments is one of the rare areas where you can kind of have your cake and eat it too, right? Meaning that I think what the government really is looking for, I mean, there's been cooperation with the payment networks and government on multiple levels since the dawn of time, right, since the dawn of these payment networks. And I think it just relates to encryption and tokenization. I mean, that's the issue of securing the data at its endpoint, right? It ensuring it doesn't get compromised there. But the wants and needs of the government as it relates to payment tends to be more about where was that payment credential used?
Mm-hmm.
How was it used in its patterns and so on and so forth? And then if we see certain patterns of usage, then drilling down into the actual use case. So I think if the payments, using obviously a combination of tokenization, secure the data, then encryption around that data when it is secured and sort of dormant, I think there's absolutely ways you can have both. But I think that I agree with Michael that there are challenges. I think that you can't, you know, remember from our panel, the general mentioned, and I agree with, right? There is a balance. You can't have both, where the government has its wants and needs and industry cooperates around that. But I think there needs to be much more a realization that that is a symbiotic relationship. You have to kind of work together. Right, and I think I don't want to get too far off the rails here talking about Apple, but I think that's a case where it's not a very productive dialogue, and you're seeing them act a bit like a petulant child, right, arguing about we want this, yet this shouldn't even be a conversation happening in the public sector. This shouldn't be happening behind closed doors. This is a PR stunt gone awry, right? So, you know, that's at least one way to look at it as far as at least the Apple case.
Well, it's interesting because I read a story about Richard Clark, who obviously is former CIA intelligence officer as well, who knows an awful lot about this area, and said, I don't really understand what the issue is. NSA could crack into this phone if they wanted to. Why has this become a public issue? And then 3 days later, what do you know? It seems like that's what's going on. But sticking to payments and encryption and authentication. So does encryption make it harder for this public-private symbiotic relationship to happen, not necessarily in areas of examining transactions, but thinking about things like KYC and, you know, anti-money laundering and the things that really can provide telltales for, you know, incidences that could be related to much bigger threats to the homeland?
Well, I guess I'll start on that one, Jared. Just really quick, I think that you tend to, you know, the government is in what it does. I think most people learn, you know, I'm not some advocate for the NSA or anything out here, as they're, you know, the lobbying organization, but I think that they tend to be a little more benign in their mission, right? That very much as us in the payments and commerce industry love analytics, right? Love looking through analytics at these different endpoints to see patterns and be able to offer services for our customers. I think you tend to see similar things in this community. As it relates to KYC and all these things that we have to go through in the payment space and the onboarding space, those are processes I think that can run in conjunction with encryption, right? Encryption is when the data is in transit, but when you're hitting the multiple different data points to go through that KYC process, it's a very interconnected system. And so you can, in my mind, be able to secure the data to go through that business seeing it, right? But still be able to go through some of these KYC and AML processes, you know, fairly securely. I think that Michael made a very good point that there's two distinctions between when we're talking about payment information and the communication channels, right? Those are different areas that, much the same way we encrypt transaction data in the payment space, they're trying to encrypt it in some of these communication apps, and that is a problem vector, right? That is an area that when you can't see that communication, that's a problem. But I think as it relates to payment and financial services, I think we're talking about established practices. And I still think that it can coincide very well.
So, Michael, I want to pick up on something you said at the Innovation Project discussion, and it relates to identity. Mm-hmm. And it also does tie in a little bit to what we're learning about the Brussels situation, where you said identities are getting easier and easier to compromise, mm-hmm. and it will only get easier. And we're learning that, one of the alleged terrorist suicide bombers had a fake ID and was moving all around Europe, renting apartments and moving quite freely with a fake ID. How do we stop that?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities when you look at what do we do in authentication or crime prevention and the way kind of diseases look. Right, we constantly, when there's a disease, we develop a cure for it, and then the disease evolves, it becomes harder for us to treat. When you look at identity, 20 years ago, college kids were faking identity just to get into a bar and get a drink. They were really easy to fake, and they were really easy to spot if you're an intelligence or crime prevention organization. Right, as we became better at finding those fake identities, the criminals creating new ones. And now you can fake a passport that will be extremely hard for anyone to notice.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's harder and harder for the true holder or the true owner of the identity to prove that he is actually himself versus easier and easier for a criminal to fake a new identity. We have so many different pieces of our identity floating around. Every time we interact with someone, there is a piece of that identity that we expose. And because it's kind of getting easier for criminals to steal that, you would expect, you see the authentication agencies are starting to ask for more and more details. And when they get compromised, it's even easier for the criminals to use those to create the new identity and so on and so forth. So I think one of the suggestions or one of the ways I talked about in our innovation project panel was let's stop looking at the identity and let's start looking at the behavior of that specific incident, because that one I can't fake.
Mm-hmm.
I do is constant. I have to do it because that, in a way, kind of discloses my motivation for that action.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter whether the person who uses a certain credit card, whether he is Michael or Sean. What matters is, do we have a legitimate access to that card, or do we intend to make that purchase as regular people or as criminals? And there are different ways to identify that.
So if the criminals are getting better at assuming identity, because they're not stealing account credentials, they're stealing personal information about an individual and creating new accounts for that person. Is encryption still relevant then in this debate?
I think it is, actually. Well, Karen, I think your mic makes a good point that I think people are trying to go and increasingly steal these identities. But I think you have to look at two key areas, right, of what really comprises this identity circle. Right? One of them is actually remotely being able to establish an identity. We have initiatives like FIDO, and we're trying to secure the ability to verify that that is the right individual in sort of a remote setting. I think there's that second step of right now we have physical credentials that we're presenting to somebody, whether it's at the TSA or you name it, and they go, oh, I think that's you, right? And I think that we have to move to a world of transactional identity, right, where, you know, big thing on Cortex is we have our overfile system, we can provision those credentials down and get those, you know, licenses and others scanned and verified. I think we have to look at that as sort of a two-step process. One, if you steal that PII, making sure that, you know, or anybody can verify truly that they are the right person. But after that, secondarily, moving to a process where we can, in real time, be able to verify and those credentials as valid. Because it's mind-blowing that we still live in a world of connected commerce and a bunch of connected devices. And the final arbiter for that driver's license is a bouncer at $8 an hour going, yeah, I think that's you. You know, I think that we have to be able to secure that endpoint much more effectively. And you're starting to see that. And we obviously do it for transit credentials and things like that, but we do have to move that to an identity world. And I think that'll be able to secure not only when people try to compromise that data, but after they do that, doing it in much more of a transactional environment where that data is real. And so you're starting to see that, and I think, but you know, it's constantly as a cat and mouse. It will be us and the criminals going back and forth, but a lot of the same technologies we're employing around payment and tokenization really have a lot of transferability to sort of a transactional identity world, right? And having that be much more an effective way for us to think about securing that identity transactionally and restricting certain use cases around it, right?
Michael, I'm curious because I know your background is as part of Israeli intelligence, and I'm curious if you had a white sheet of paper and you could design a system that would accomplish what we're trying to accomplish in commerce, which is protecting customer information, protecting account information, of course, and doing our level best to make sure that neither of those things are compromised by those who wish whatever, whether it's a merchant or a bank or the homeland, ill will. How would you design a system?
So unfortunately, I think there is no perfect system, no weather. Even if we scratch everything and we're built from scratch, we have to remember that there's a very, very weak link in that whole process, and that's people.
Mm-hmm.
And as someone once said, probably 20 years ago, there is no patch for human stupidity. It doesn't matter how many layers of protection do you have. If I can call someone in the bank and ask him for his password and he gives it to me, it doesn't matter what happens later.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would be surprised how often does that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I can create the most secure system that all the data is encrypted and I know how to verify everything, and then someone creates, and these are all real cases, right? Someone creates a dating app and has thousands of people register to it, giving him their picture, their address, their phone, a bunch of questions about them, and then uses that information that people voluntarily gave him as a criminal to call their bank and authenticate himself. And the person on the other side of that line is also not very, very trained in deception spotting, and he just lets him change his address on his bank account. And it happens every day and probably hundreds of times a day. So I think we need to first protect our data more closely. Both the responsibility falls for the organizations rather than individuals. And here encryption plays a very, very important. I think ever since we started tokenizing credit cards, it makes stealing a particular credit card harder. And it pushed the problem to different areas. If we solved or made it substantially harder, if we start encrypting all of our data, it'll be harder to steal.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that the system is perfect now, but it removes a lot of unsophisticated or untrained fraudsters or criminals from that market. And second, we need to invest a lot as an industry. And I think the government has a role to play here, well, all governments, in training people and making them aware. The media has a role to play here that it's a risky world out there. And people will always try to compromise your identity for their benefit. Now, it's not a lot of people, but they're very, very trained and very, very well motivated.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes down to people more than systems.
Got it. I think that's a good point. Sean, your response to that?
Yeah, but I totally agree with that. I think that, you know, there's kind of a couple things. First, you obviously have to always, Michael made a good point, there is no magic bullet, right? The more that you put a credence into a particular authentication scheme, the more risky, the more risky you put your whole organization, right? We talk about single sign-on. Verify you sign on once, you get access to everything. Well, that also creates, on the flip side, a tremendous amount of risk,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think that you have to have a multi-layered approach, right? There has to be several different layers in that security apparatus. If you ever fly El Al, go to Israel, it's one of the most secure airlines in the world. And it's very effective. You check in, there's somebody looking at you, and there's one guy not even just looking at your body language and behavior. It's a very effective security apparatus. And I think that organizations have to think that way, that there is no magic bullet, to be very vigilant. I think that I also agree that we need to also push a little more of this responsibility back onto the consumer or the individual, right? We live in this world that my credit card gets compromised. Oh, the bank is going to give me my money at X, Y, and Z. I mean, that might work to a certain extent, but it's very much like insurance. It does take a proactive role by the individual to be much more vigilant about protecting their own identity, right, and how they go about using it. And so I think that there needs to be an education. I think you're right. It's an unsecure world, and you as a consumer can take certain steps that in and of itself can secure the system, right? Be more proactive in how you protect that identity. It doesn't mean go sign up for LifeLock or something right away, right? But there's other things that you can do just that are very simple to always realize that there are threats out there and just be a little bit smarter and how you distribute that identity and whom you give it to and in what capacity, right? And so I think that between those combinations, it's the best mix of things. But again, there is always a threat vector out there that you can't patch. And stupidity obviously is one of them.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think it's going to take a lot of education to get consumers to feel as though this is their responsibility, because they've been trained for many years that the compromise of their card information is not anything that they have to worry about, not as if they're careless with card information, because I think generally consumers, you know, do monitor their transaction activity and they are very much in touch with things that may be fraudulent on their accounts. But it's not as if they toss and turn at night about it, because they've been trained to understand that the bank has their back. I think this is a whole different situation where they're tuned into the risk, but I'm not sure that they believe they have a part to play in securing it. I think that this is where they think someone needs to help me help myself. So I think that's where...
You're right. I think one thing you see, though, Karen, and this is just a point people should be, and I was listening to this and they've had it happen to them. You know, if you ever had a breach or ever had your data compromised, you know, it's like saying you live in the middle of a terrible neighborhood with your door wide open, but you got a decent insurance policy. right? You're still getting robbed.
Right.
There's still an impact on your life. And so you've seen that once people have kind of gone through that, they tend to be a little more proactive, and hopefully not that they're losing sleep at night, but at least they're making more initiative.
I think, Sean, thanks for making the LOL comment, because I have a great example about this. I think before we start educating the consumers, which we should, we need to educate the companies in the middle. And we, in my mind, have to minimize the human element as much as possible. And I'll give you an example. I was flying one of the major European airlines back home at the time to Tel Aviv. And they said, oh, you're flying to Tel Aviv? I have to ask you a few questions. Now, I'm used to that because that's the way LOL does. And then the person there reads the questions from the sheet of paper he has and expects an answer. And my reaction is, wait, the answers don't matter. What you have to look is looking at me and seeing how I'm responding to those and whether I'm nervous about a particular thing, what kind of words am I using to respond for it. And it was clear to her that she was told, you need to read those questions, get those answers, and then move on without understanding why it matters and what is she here to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
If you have, kind of moving to the financial system, we see a lot of transactions at Border, and in several cases, we clearly know that what happened there was that some fraudster find a way to trick a clerk at a specific branch of a bank to let him change the addresses that are registered for that account. And that way, he was able to trick the ABS system and get a positive response to his fraudulent address versus the right one. We called that bank and said, well, you have a systematic breach in that branch. You need to take care of it. And they didn't care.
Wow.
And they didn't train their people, and they didn't want it exposed. And I think the banks should care about it. They have to be forced to train their people. And in as many places as possible, they need to remove the human element.
Wow.
So if you've been to Google, too, right? Google's very good if you walk around their campus and you're not badged. Any random employee will turn around and go, hey, can I see a badge? Can I see a pay? They're very vigilant about at least, you know, sort of perimeter security and access control, and that's in the culture. And that's something that actually works very well.
Wow. So final question. And, you know, this is obviously as a result of the situation in Brussels. So, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste if you're a senator or a member of the House of Representatives. So there's now the increased intensity, at least in the Senate, to escalate the passage of a bill related to encryption and cybersecurity, forcing this opportunity for governments to have access to data that's encrypted in order to keep the homeland safe. I mean, you know, regulation is always a blunt instrument to sort of fix these problems, but it strikes me as perhaps a slippery slope for those of us in payments and financial services if something like that were to gain momentum and in fact pass. Your thoughts?
Well, I think I made that point during the panel. The problem is, as the world becomes a global one, it's not really clear which government has the authority to do what.
Right.
If one of those governments gets access, let's say Visa has all the rails encrypted and all the transactions are completely protected. And then the U.S. government says, well, we need access to that system for us to be able to see who's moving money where. And Visa complies. What moral grounds is there for a Visa to reject the same access to all the other governments in the world, that they're tracking the money movement for their particular purposes? And in that case, we're actually undermining and giving everyone, and not all governments have the best intentions for all people.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the sake of argument, assume that some of those governments have good intentions for some of their people. But it really creates an internal conflict. I think Visas, or just as an example here, any or Apple, you know, because it's a more kind of current situation, they have to protect the consumer in the best way they think possible. If the government has an issue with it, the government has to solve it on its own. In my mind, what happened here is way worse. Now everyone knows that the U.S. government actually found a way through that phone. Now everyone in the world knows that there's some flaw in Apple's security system, that someone found a way to bypass it. Now all of them will start trying to do the same.
Wow.
Which will actually force Apple to upgrade that system and make sure that that flow doesn't work. If the FBI kept quiet and just found a way to penetrate that system without anyone knowing, there'll be a way better outcome for everyone. And so I really think that it's really bad what happened here, and even the legitimacy this claim got from a lot of people in the media, and in even our...
So, Sean, you have the last word.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of issues here. I think, first of all, I think that this legislation is nothing more than a reaction to Apple taking this thing to the public sphere, right? I think there's plenty of legislation out there to cover all of these issues. We don't need any more, right? And, you know, the legislation is the enemy of progress, and bureaucracy is the enemy of innovation, right? We know that. but I think that we also have to understand that companies operating, you will always have nation states, right? And as Michael pointed out, nation states will always have their own self-interest in mind. And I think that we're a little bit naive to think that when Apple has gone to China and was selling phones there, there weren't similar requests or augmentations of the OS that had to be put in place, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's always a balancing act between the companies and the governments and where they have to do business and do things. But I think that it's a good point. Companies should first start with, how am I going to protect my consumer and do certain things? And then in the context of where and how they do business, cooperating with the governments in a way that sort of strikes that balance, right? And again, you don't do that by just shutting it off and having a PR war. You do it by having, you know, smart ways to cooperate when you bring out product, when you have these issues. I think that people can be rational to know that, yeah, Apple shouldn't let everybody eavesdrop on every question 24/7. But if issues do come about, you know, that if you are going to operate in that particular spectrum in a particular country, they do have that final fulcrum to shut you out, lock you out of the network, right? And so, you know, there has to be, you can't just say, no, we're not going to get along. So I think the more cooperative and collaborative these things can be, right, I think the more effective it'll be, and the system will work better, right? And just some legislation by a senator trying to show off and grandstand is the worst thing. To actually do it, has to just be done smartly and cooperatively, and we'll kind of be able to have this whole world run a little bit smoother. Right?
Well, the one thing I can safely predict is that this isn't the last conversation we'll have on this topic. I think this is a really interesting topic to talk about, and I think your very thoughtful responses to this debate are really things that the ecosystem needs to take into consideration and think deeply about, and hopefully our lawmakers as well. I think we need to stop taking these knee-jerk reactions to what is a moment in time and to step back and think, what is it that we're really trying to accomplish and what do we need to do in order to protect consumers, their right to security and privacy, enterprises, their right to security and privacy, and clearly the homeland, which everyone is interested now in protecting more than ever, given the unfortunate situations that we're observing in Europe. Michael, Sean, thanks so much for taking the time today to share your thoughts with us. It was really a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.